This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We are live tweeting at KUOW, so tweet at us during this program. We might read your comments on the air. Yesterday, the Seattle City Council voted unanimously to move its money, $3 billion, in business with Wells Fargo Bank. City lawmakers don't like Wells Fargo's funding of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and they don't like some of the bank's questionable business practices. Fine. So now the question is, where will the city's money end up? Seattle Weekly reporter Sarah Bernard, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks.
So now we have divestment from Wells Fargo. What does it actually do?
Well, what happened yesterday was that the Seattle City Council unanimously passed an ordinance to end the city's $3 billion relationship with Wells Fargo. And that means when the contract, the financial services contract that the city has with Wells Fargo ends at the end of 2018, then they will let that contract lapse. So that means essentially the city of Seattle said, we don't agree with some of the practices that we see coming out of Wells Fargo, including financing the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we want to bank with another bank.
So Sarah, how hard is it to find a bank that you can do, a big city can do business with that is so-called an ethical bank?
It might be kind of difficult. I think that there are a lot of criteria that the city is looking at that might not apply to large national, multinational corporations. As far as I know so far, Council Member Lisa Herbold's office has done some research, looked around, and in terms of the kinds of banks that might fall under this criteria so far, her office has found about 7 that operate in Washington that could possibly work. So I think that's going to be kind of difficult because I imagine, you know, large multinational national corporations, there's often something that they're funding that could be controversial. The other thing is that essentially the more socially responsible financial institutions are going to be credit unions or local banks, small banks. And there is a state law right now that prohibits a city, a public entity like a city or a county to deposit more than $250,000 into a credit union.
The city had how many billion with Wells Fargo?
$3 billion. Yeah. And so $3 billion means essentially the money that was moving in and out of Wells Fargo during the course of a year. So any average balance that the city had sort of sitting in the bank was about $10 million, which is also a lot of money. But $3 billion was sort of managing all the money, that the revenue that would come into the city, and sort of moving that money in and out of the bank. So regardless, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. The real question is, what small local bank or credit union could really insure that kind of money?
Yeah. Then there's the idea of a public bank. There's a bill in the state legislature to create a public bank in Washington state. What would that mean exactly?
Yeah, so that is interesting. There's only one state, as far as I know, there's only one state that uses a public bank, and that's North Dakota. But I guess it's been in the works for a couple of years, but Senator Bob Hasegawa has sponsored it again this legislative session. It would sort of create a public agency that is a bank. The benefit would be, from the point of view, I think, of the people who are supporting this idea, is that it would cost the state less money in fees and interests to be managing its own money literally and not sort of relying on the private banking industry, which is designed to profit.
Right. Private banks designed to suck some money out of all those transactions.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the idea. And I know that Council Member Mike O'Brien is really excited about that idea. He brought it up last week during the Finance Committee meeting, and he also brought it up again yesterday during the City Council meeting. So he's really encouraging people to look into that.
I'm talking with Sarah Bernard, a reporter for Seattle Weekly, who's covered this move by the Seattle City Council of pulling its money from Wells Fargo Bank. I wonder if there's a chance that the city's been too hasty moving the money before they know exactly what they're going to do with the money, where they're going to put it.
Well, the good news, I think, is that actually they haven't moved the money yet. So that's really, I think, excellent for the city because they've made this public statement. I think a lot of the activists working to defund the Dakota Access Pipeline. There have been activists in Seattle, activists across the country that are watching Seattle right now. It's a really big deal for the people who are advocating against the Dakota Access Pipeline. But they're not moving the money today. They have almost 2 years to figure it out because the contract that they have with Wells Fargo right now goes through the end of 2018. So the decision was ultimately to let that contract lapse, but not until 2018. So they have time to figure it out. I think they have their work cut out for them. But
Finally, Sarah, I've heard some critics of this say that a major city like Seattle should not run its banking decisions through protesters, the axes to be grinded, you know, that the city's just setting itself up for trouble. Do you have any sense of whether that's a legitimate concern?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I don't know. It seems also as though the city has been committed to the idea of socially responsible investments and socially responsible banking and business practices for a while now. They are really responsive to public pressure, but I wouldn't be totally surprised if the solution didn't live up to snuff for some of the activists out there.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be really fascinating to see, can a big city do billions of dollars of socially responsible banking? And maybe other cities and companies will be watching us. Seattle Weekly reporter Sarah Bernard, thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you.
So we talked there about Wells Fargo's funding of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Well, that pipeline project has just won a big government decision. Construction might just start up again today. We are going to tell you what happened and what the pipeline protesters might do next. That's coming up in about 5 minutes on KUOW's The Record. President Obama's Affordable Care Act is providing health care to millions of Americans, more than 1 million of them in Washington state. President Trump's administration and Republicans in Congress say that Obamacare costs too much and that it doesn't work well enough. So KOW's Emily Fox asked Dr. Jeff Duchin, public health officer for Seattle and King County, who has the most to lose if Obamacare goes away?
Poor people and people of color, particularly blacks, live shorter lives, they have higher rates of disease, and they get sick at younger ages than wealthier people and whites. African Americans are at increase for almost every adverse health outcome you can measure, including shorter life expectancy, higher infant mortality rates, higher incidence of cancers and cardiovascular disease. And poor people and people of color also have a higher incidence of the risk factors, behaviors, and exposures, such as diabetes, smoking, and obesity, that lead to these poor health outcomes. So blacks and other people of color were more likely not to have insurance prior to the ACA compared to whites.
So we talked a little bit about African Americans. What about other people of color in terms of what the Affordable Care Act has meant for them?
Well, the Affordable Care Act has provided benefits to people across all races, ethnicities, and income spectrums. But I do think that it's important to highlight the fact that because African Americans were at the highest risk, they have benefited the most. But we've seen rates of insurance increase for every racial and ethnic group, including whites.
What could change for people of color if Obamacare goes away?
Well, a lot could change. I mean, people could lose their insurance benefits, which would mean not only, again, developing preventable illnesses, but not having the ability to see a doctor when you're sick. It has tremendous both health and economic implications. People will have to pay for services that previously would be covered. There are some very basic clinical services that are required by ACA, including prevention and immunization, emergency department visits, chronic medical care, maternal and child services, behavioral health, dental, vision. All of these are things that are required by ACA. Not having health insurance not only is bad for the person who doesn't have health insurance because they are suffering with an illness that they delay care for and potentially have a more serious outcome, but it's also more expensive for them when they do seek health care because they don't have insurance, and it's also more expensive for us as a society because we're paying for health care some other way through people who are seeking care who are uninsured and going to hospitals, and those services cost money that we have to pay, you know, together, find another way as our community to pay.
Who are the least covered in terms of health care?
Right now in King County, we have rates of uninsurance among Hispanics at about 30%, down from 42% before Affordable Care Act, but they are currently the most uncovered ethnic group. Our Alaska Native American Indian population has an uninsurance rate of 19%. Our Pacific Islanders have an uninsurance rate of 11%. We also need to focus on the other major drivers of health in our community, which are things like access to employment, economic opportunity, social conditions such as housing, the environment, the types of neighborhoods we live in, the opportunity for education and good quality schools, safety of our neighborhoods. Racism is another driver of health. In addition to providing health care, we really need to focus on some of these more upstream determinants of health, which are the things that keep us from getting sick in the first place.
That's Dr. Jeff Duchin, public health officer for Seattle and King County, talking there about wealth and race when it comes to the Affordable Care Act and health care in this country. You know, KOW is examining the ways that racial inequity shapes the greater Seattle region, and I hope you will get involved in that conversation. It's happening now on KOW's Facebook page. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. Construction on the final mile and a half of the Dakota Access Pipeline is going to start up again. In fact, it could start today. The Army Corps of Engineers cut short the environmental impact assessment that had stopped construction of the pipeline back in December. The pipeline will run under the Missouri River, which is the water source for the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Reporter Linda Mapes has been following this story for the Seattle Times. She says this dispute between the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and the company building the pipeline has been going on for years, but it only came to national attention really last April.
This was a woman, a Standing Rock Sioux tribal member, who just set up a prayer camp at the urging of some of the tribal youth. And they put out a call for people to pray and to join them. And to their immense surprise, tribal nations, not only from around the country, but the world, began to arrive. And so it spread to a second camp and a third camp, the largest, which is by the river. We've all seen pictures of it by now in the newspapers and on television. This camp began to draw people from around the world, not only tribal nations, but their allies, to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline, to push back and fight for, by then, a whole suite of issues, from a zero carbon energy source to, defending the climate to indigenous rights. It became a really important gathering, such as had really never been seen before, of Native nations from all over the world, all over the country, but also their allies. And there are still about 400 people in that camp today.
Construction could begin today. The Army Corps of Engineers decided to cut this environmental impact assessment short and grant this easement to the pipeline. How unexpected was that decision?
Not unexpected at all. I mean, the Trump administration, while he was still a candidate, Trump was let's remember, an owner of stock in this company, Energy Transfer Partners. And Energy Transfer Partners was a major contributor to his campaign. So he's been allied with not only the fossil fuel industry broadly, but this company in particular. And, you know, he's been a supporter of infrastructure development, fossil fuel infrastructure development. There isn't a pipeline he doesn't like. So none of this is a surprise. He said he was going to do it. Sure enough, of course, he did it. But, you know, I think similarly, as with the travel ban, what we're all going to watch unfold now is the inevitable pushback in the courts and from the people. You know, it's not as simple as just putting out a tweet or dropping a piece of paper. I mean, these things happen within administrative procedures and legal contexts. And so here we go. The tribe has said they would sue as soon as this happened. And indeed, they're preparing their lawsuit and will be in court, I'm quite sure, very soon to push back and say, actually, no, you can't just put the brakes on an ongoing environmental review enacted by a prior administration just because you don't like it. You know, under the Administrative Procedure Act, you have to show that was an arbitrary and capricious decision by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. You can't just wave a wand and make it go poof.
How strong do you think the tribe's legal argument is?
You know, I think that we'll see is the best answer I can give to that. They obviously think it's very convincing, not only on the basis of this having been a sound decision, but on the basis of treaty rights. You know, they have treaty rights in the lake that was created by the damming of the Missouri River, which, by the way, took out all of their best farmland. I mean, the sadnesses of this story just pile one on another after another. I mean, one of the reasons this has been such a flashpoint is because of the history of this place and these people. I mean, this is the tribe of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and some of the most gruesome massacres of innocent people. And it's very recent history. This was one of the last tribes to face the U.S. cavalry. And so it's very recent history. It's very bitter history. And when the company says, oh, it's all private land, you have nothing to say about it, that's just salt in the wound. The reason it's private land is because a lot of it was just plain taken, and it was never actually ceded by treaty. And so they feel like a lot of this is stolen land, and that this is just one more outrage in a very old history.
We're talking with Seattle Times environmental reporter Linda Mapes about the construction that could start today on this Dakota Access Pipeline. Once the builders get this easement to go under the Missouri River, how quick could this project be done?
This is a surprising thing. You know, there are crews standing by in hotel rooms just waiting for the green light. And if they work 24 hours, 7 day shifts, they could be done in 2 weeks. Now, they may or may not do that because let's remember the tribe's going to go to court. And if a court issues any kind of emergency measure, it would stop construction. Interestingly, the tribe has said that even if this pipeline is completed, they will then try to stop the flow of oil. So I don't think...
Stop the flow of oil?
Correct.
It can get the oil shut off?
Sure, why not? You bet. Yeah. I mean, it's a fight that we're all going to be living with for quite some time. So, you know, finishing up the actual work is simple and quick. Even in bad weather, you know, the pipeline is laid, the ground is covered, it's been tested. All the preparations are in place. This was this company's strategy from the beginning, to keep on building even in advance of having some of the easements that they needed to finish. And so now they're ready to go, but it doesn't mean that they will in fact finish it in 2 weeks. It'll depend on what the courts do.
Well, when the tribe got that victory, we talked with you about how significant that was. And now, in light of the fact that construction could start right up today and be done in 2 weeks, I gotta ask you again, how much of a victory was won on that day?
I still think it's incredibly important. And here's why. Number one, it brought together a gathering of nations that we have not seen in modern times. And it also turned into a kind of training camp for activists. By the thousands, literally, there were 10,000 people there in December, a fact I still am amazed by. Those people have not just dusted off their hands and say, all done with that. They're now turning their attention to all these other pipelines, including, by the way, the Trans Mountain Pipeline in our backyard. I mean,
in Canada.
Yes, right over the border. And by the way, bigger than Dakota Access, tar sands oil, dirtier.
Headed to near Vancouver.
It's right in Metro Vancouver. So yeah. I find it incredible to think of what's ahead for us here in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, if this is what building an oil pipeline in rural North Dakota looks like, I can't wait to watch it go down in Metro Vancouver.
Speaking of rural North Dakota, it is February in Dakota. Obviously cold. There are still protesters there, as you've said. What's happening now at the camp in light of this news that construction could fire back up?
Couple of things. The Corps of Engineers, they own that land, by the way, has said that they are going to close that camp on the 22nd of the month. And the reason for that is floodwater. I mean, this area will be underwater. It's been a 10-year high snow year this winter. And so something's going to have to happen with those people. They will either relocate to other camps upriver in places where they can stay. But they can't stay there. And the tribe, interestingly, has been asking people to leave and stay away, to move this battle into the courts and stay in the political process. There's going to be an indigenous march on Washington on the 10th of March, which will probably bring thousands of Native people and their allies. you know, that the tribe is now saying that this fight is in another place and please take it there. However, I don't think it's going to be that easy to just put the smoke back in the chimney, the genie back in the bottle. I mean, there's a very strong feeling around this project. And I talked to Standing Rock Sioux tribal members yesterday here in Seattle, actually, who had left the camp and are headed back. And I'm worried about those people. I'm worried about them in a lot of ways. I'm worried about the flooding, but I'm also worried about, you know, what will happen if they get into clashes with police. I mean, you saw the state of North Dakota roll out an 8-state police force to defend construction of this private oil pipeline. Last November, 7 people went to the hospital. I mean, it's potentially a very volatile situation. When we were there in October, it was when things first started blowing up. And I mean, I frankly was amazed nobody got killed. And so I worry about what's ahead, and I don't feel like I have any idea what is ahead. I honestly think anything could happen.
Linda Mapes, environmental reporter for the Seattle Times, telling you about the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Construction on the final mile and a half of that pipeline project could resume any time. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You know, the Dakota Access Pipeline is news, it's current events, but really, it's a continuation of history, according to our next guests. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Giglio Whitaker have written a book called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Roxanne says for most Americans, learning about Native life ends at Hollywood Westerns and grade school textbooks.
In Hollywood Westerns, you have Indians dying over and over and over again. They never win. You know, it's just they get, and every movie, they're dying. So for generations of young people growing up, that's what they see: dead Indians being killed, and they see it as a triumph, you know, that because they're the enemy. So this then means that all the real Indians, that is the authentic Indians, those that survived, assimilated, you know, they're just other Americans. So the real Indians, the authentic Indians, are said to no longer exist.
Can I ask, what is the myth of the dead Indians? What does that do for the dominant American culture? It survives because it's accomplished. It's useful. Mm-hmm. What's the use?
Well, it reinforces another narrative, which is all about European superiority. And that's a narrative that follows the Europeans, the very earliest Europeans. I mean, you know, these are people who are, they're Puritans, they're the people of God, they have, it's already built in to their own belief systems that they are the righteous ones, the chosen ones, and you know, they have the right to inherit the land. And so this is something, again, that gets played out over and over again over centuries. And to this day, the system of federal Indian law is built on this underlying narrative of European cultural and religious superiority.
Do you trace this story of European superiority down to today's Dakota Access Pipeline standoff, today's presidential election? What connections are you making?
In a way, this particular pipeline is like the last straw. No more, you know, so taking a stand. So it's a continuation of history for the Sioux people, but for, say, a new generation, especially of Americans, they say, wow, this is, you know, they didn't know any of this history. So it is a learning process, and it's one of the few times ever that there has been a really positive media coverage. Now, to lead, you know, the presidential election, this puts a kind of pall on everything, you know, that first of all, you don't have any idea what President Trump is going to do. But one thing we know is he's filled with revenge, and he does hate Native Americans because of the casinos and his failure in Atlantic City. He's a bad businessman, went bankrupt. But he blames Indian casinos for taking away his business. So he has an actual, you know, vengeance So it's not going to be a good time, you know, for Native people and the federal government.
I want to touch on another myth in your book because it's gotten so much attention lately in the World Series, and that is the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins and the myth of honoring indigenous people. Will you tell us what that myth is?
Yes, that's the one of the most pernicious ones, and I think the, in some ways, the hardest to explain to people because they think, well, Native people just don't have a sense of humor, you know. This is sports. This is a game. But it's also the imagery of sort of like the Nazi era, how Jews were depicted in cartoons and all. And we see this with Muslims, too, being depicted in these hateful ways. And it's bad enough to have Cleveland Indians or the Warriors or the Chiefs and all those things, and also military equipment by those names. But Redskins is beyond the pale. I feel that when people really know the history of that term, where it comes from, why it was used very early on in Massachusetts Bay Colony, the bounties for heads of Indians, this became a commerce in itself. Of the way people made their living was killing Indians and bringing the heads in, and blood has flown, so they're Redskins. I mean, if you take a look at Native people, their skin is not red, it's brown, you know. Brown or many colors, sometimes often towards black or very light, but never is it red. Only white people are pink sometimes, or orange.
You said Natives don't have sense of humor. Which is it?
It's, you know what? It's Indian sense of humor. We always say this in Indian country. If it wasn't for our ability to laugh, we wouldn't have survived. It's something that all Indian people know. And so there's a certain, like, Indian humor.
That's a sort of gallows humor.
It is a gallows humor. Being able to laugh in the middle of the darkest, most, you know, morose situations.
Is that an important myth? I don't know if it actually makes your book as a myth, but the sort of joyless image.
That's right. The solemn.
Stoic
Indian. The wooden Indian. Yeah. You know, the wooden Indian as a symbol of that. And so Indians aren't supposed to talk. You know, they're supposed to be mute. I love that in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the Will Sampson character who could talk, but he wasn't talking. But he fit
the big
that.
Chief.
He was portrayed as that image of the silent Indian. And it then becomes a demand, keep your mouth shut, you know, Indians aren't supposed to talk.
What do you wish a white American would think? We think in images, we think in stereotypes. What's an image you wish people had? Indian, and the myth is what, or the image is what?
They don't necessarily fit any particular image. They don't necessarily have dark skin. They don't necessarily have long black hair. They don't necessarily have dark eyes. They don't wear feathers and beads. They might wear suits, and they do. They wear spacesuits. John Harrington, famous Chickasaw astronaut, is at the top of his league. He's a scientist, he's an astronaut, and he's very, very rooted in his culture. We tell a story in the book about John Harrington, who goes into space. He flew into space and went to the International Space Station, and he brought with him eagle feathers, he brought sage, and he brought the flag of the Chickasaw Nation. So he even though he went out into space, he brought all those symbols of his identity. That was a form of resistance for him, of not fitting into any kind of prescribed image or role. And that's really what you're talking about, a myth that Indians can't be modern. That's tied to erasure and Indians not being able to live up to these impossible ideals that are stuck in a frozen past. Indians can only be real in extinct past, which is a real catch-22, but connected to that is this
idea that in order to be Indian, you can't be modern. You can't fit these images. But Native people are doing it all the time. And so that's what I wish for dominant society to get.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Dina Gilio-Whitaker, authors of the book All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. What do you think? What would you add to that conversation? What's your experience with myths about Native Americans or other people? We'd like to hear from you. You can find KUOW on Twitter and Facebook. You can email us, record@kuow.org. We love when you leave us a voicemail, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. It's The Record on KUOW, Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Did you hear what happened on the U.S. Senate floor yesterday? The Democratic Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren stood up to oppose the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions as U.S. Attorney General. And in so doing, Senator Warren read out loud from a letter that Dr. Martin Luther King's widow wrote back in the 1980s when Sessions was being nominated for a federal judgeship.
Mr. Sessions' conduct as U.S. attorney, from his politically motivated voting fraud prosecutions to his indifference toward criminal violations of civil rights laws, indicates that he lacks the temperament, fairness, and judgment to be a federal judge.
As Senator Warren was reading that letter, Montana Republican Steve Daines cuts her off.
A person who has exhibited so much hostility to the enforcement of those laws.
The senator is reminded that it is a violation of Rule 19 of the standing rules of the Senate to impute to another senator or senators any conduct or motive unworthy or becoming a senator.
To which Senator Warren replies, "You know, these aren't my words."
Mr. President, I don't think I quite understand. I'm reading a letter from Coretta Scott King to the Judiciary Committee from 1986 that was admitted into the record. I'm simply reading what she wrote.
Well, her argument didn't work. The Republican leader forced Warren to sit down, and now she is barred from speaking about Jeff Sessions' nomination as Attorney General. And how are Elizabeth Warren's Democratic colleagues reacting to that? You'll find out. This afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State's Poet Laureate is now halfway into his two-year term. KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, used to be the State Poet Laureate before Todd Marshall, so she wanted to know what Marshall's learned this past year, traveling around the state, giving readings and teaching writing workshops, especially now in these volatile times.
I like to think that poetry events can create a pretty powerful and visceral emotional reaction. But one thing I'll say for sure is that since mid-November at many of my readings, and this happens usually when I'm sharing works of others, I look up and people are crying. People are in a really raw emotional place, and they're reacting quite strongly.
Right, right. So I imagine I know what you're doing, driving around your car all over the state, over difficult mountain passes, going to urban communities, rural communities, the so-called red and blue sides of the state. You're bringing this powerful, carefully considered language that we call poems. And how is that process, how are those experiences altering your work as a poet? Is it yet? Can you tell yet?
I really can't. And, as you well know, during the time of service in this position, it's really a challenge to find time to write. Luckily, I do a lot of workshops with people, and I participate in those workshops and, make poems during that time period. I would add one footnote going back to those events. I listen to the radio a lot when I'm driving, and I listen to all different things on the radio, from music to conservative talk radio to podcasts that I find moving and compelling, to podcasts specifically about poetry. But I was listening to a podcast recently when our former inaugural poem writer, Elizabeth Alexander, asked a question at the end of the podcast: "Are we not interested in one another?" And I love that that question, and I love that line, and I love that as an energizer for me as I travel to communities where traditionally we might not think of there being a really strong devotion to the arts, because, you know, I think that oftentimes in those communities I do find a really strong interest in the arts, and I do hear stories and messages and things that I wouldn't hear otherwise. And so, you know, I think that although it's an incredibly important time to revisit precision in the usage of language, I would say it's even a much, much more important time to revisit the importance of listening and how listening can show our interest in one another.
You mentioned a moment ago, Todd, that you've been writing yourself in these workshops that you're teaching. And I understand you've brought with you a brand new poem that you wrote in one of the workshops. I'd love to hear it.
Oh, yeah, this poem is very, very new. I did a workshop at Hugo House on Saturday. It has no title. It had specific guidelines in its shaping. And as I said, it's very, very new. But here it is. We'll call it Untitled. Fishing was easy. The beautiful bluegill of Chihuahua would eat anything. Plume of the sawmill visible from everywhere in the surrounding fields and forests. Those places where we made forts as children. Little wombs where we could both hide from and practice the cruelties we were learning so quickly. Which means that when we came upon that homeless man's camp and dumped his water, burnt his soiled clothes, and scattered the bedding, we were just acting as we'd been taught. Or so I wish. The willows, anyway, didn't care. The ponderosa pines didn't care. The sky didn't care. Just held that plume of smoke, so many things we've incinerated and sent up into the blue day. The planks he'd used for a bed cracked in the fire pit. Greasy blankets in the blaze put forth a dark smell. We were boys, right? And that always seems to make it okay. An easy pardon. But maybe I'm telling this to be forgiven for so much more, for not doing enough, for fiddling with words while my country burns. It's 2017, and I can't stop thinking of that man's pained face when he came back and saw his little world ruined. Of now and what might be next. Of how, as children, we'd gut what we caught, the sweet meat of those spiny fish, blue behind the gill like the beginning of a rainbow, astonishment, beauty, something that didn't deserve to be killed. But first we'd keep them too long on a stringer until their eyes were gray and dead, until they didn't even seem as if they'd ever been alive, and then you could do anything to them. And reading that, I realize how many echoes of so many different discourses, so many different things that have been bouncing around in our culture, you know, made their way into that poem, and at least in my reaction to it.
That's Washington State Poet Laureate Todd Marshall reading a brand new and as yet untitled poem. Todd, that line, "We were boys, right, and that always seemed to make it okay, an easy pardon." That line really cuts, especially because you follow it with, "But maybe I'm telling this to be forgiven for so much more, for not doing enough, for fiddling with words while my country burns." That, to me, that draws right into my heart and what keeps me up at night. And I'm wondering if you're wrestling there with the limits of what art and artists can do.
I think I am. I think that the "We Were Boys, Right" is an echo of our cultural conversation about what we're seemingly able to forgive as locker room talk. I think that it's what we're seemingly able to give males a pass on. You know, obviously something that's been part of our cultural dialogue a lot in the last year and has been for many, 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 many years. You know, the ongoing question of the impact and importance and role of poetry and the arts writ large during times of extremity, you know, is a huge one that many writers have wrestled with. I don't know that there's any easy answer to it, But I know that sometimes it's very difficult as a writer to not feel as if you're putting your energy into a place that's not having the immediate impact that you would hope for, the immediate change that you'd hope for. An example that comes to mind is the poet George Aupin, who published poetry very early on in his writing career, and then decided that poetry wasn't where the most important work for his life journey was, and decided to devote himself to workers' issues, to full-time advocating for workers' rights in Mexico, and gave up poetry for a couple of decades almost, and then came back to the United States and soon after won the National Book Award for Of Being Numerous. And so, you know, I think about that and all of the poems that maybe didn't get written when he was doing that work. But, you know, then I also think about the immediate impact that he probably had on individuals on a very local level. And that's a very difficult balance to try to weigh and measure things in and decide what's right.
It can be very hard to see the effect of any art you make.
Yeah.
We don't often get that mirrored back to us.
Very rarely.
That's your poet laureate, Todd Marshall, laureate of Washington State, talking with the former poet laureate of the state, KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin. It's KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. President Trump is commenting on Washington State's lawsuit against his immigration ban. That ban would temporarily suspend America's refugee program and immigration from seven mostly Muslim countries. A Seattle federal judge upheld Washington State's lawsuit, which put a hold on the ban. Yesterday, a federal appeals court heard arguments from Washington State and the Trump administration. And President Trump watched TV coverage of those arguments. He did not like what he heard.
I understand things. I comprehend very well, okay? Better than, I think, almost anybody. And I want to tell you, I listened to a bunch of stuff last night on television that was disgraceful.
Trump says, as president, he has legal authority to make decisions about immigration, and that should be clear to everyone.
A bad high school student would understand this. Anybody would understand this.
President Trump says the arguments against his travel ban are all political, and hearings like the one yesterday are a big reason that courts are now held in low esteem.
If these judges wanted to, in my opinion, help the court in terms of respect for the court, they do what they should be doing. I mean, it's so sad.
The president was speaking today to a group of sheriffs and police chiefs, and he told them that this legal challenge to his travel ban is just the latest attack on law enforcement and security professionals who are trying to keep America safe.
They're taking away our weapons one by one. That's what they're doing. And you know it, and I know it, and you people have been very unhappy for a long period of time.
Later today on KUOW, we're going to look closely into President Trump's accusations against our judges and our judicial system. That's coming up later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. You know who's pushing back against the president's immigration ban besides the state of Washington is American tech companies. Amazon and Microsoft are both backing Washington's lawsuit against this ban. And now, tech companies who might worry about being able to bring in foreign talent, well, they could just look north to Canada. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer joins us now for that story. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
So typically it would be liberals threatening to move to Canada, but these U.S. tech firms, Apple, Microsoft, Google, are they really thinking of crossing the border to escape the Trump administration?
Well, I'll tell you, Bill, that there are some Canadian politicians and some Canadian tech companies that think there's an opportunity here. They've noticed that a lot of the backlash against the president's restrictions on immigration, leading the way are a lot of big U.S. tech firms. I think the reason for that is because the technology industry is global. It relies on people moving all over the world. And there's some thought up here in Canada that maybe we can take advantage of this. It's political opportunism. It's economic opportunism as well. And we've seen some of our politicians up here jump on it. Premier of British Columbia, Christy Clark, the day after the president first announced the crackdown, the one that's being challenged in court. The day after that, the Premier of British Columbia, Clark, said she thought there was an opportunity for British Columbia to take advantage of this, and she announced a fairly significant tax break to attract people from other countries to come here and work in our technology industries.
Yes, this is the bait on the hook. It has to do with the foreign buyer tax that we have talked about for British Columbia real estate buyers.
Yes, so Bill, last summer, the government of British Columbia very concerned about foreign real estate speculators, people who were coming here buying housing, not even living in it, some cases leaving it vacant just as an investment, and driving up the price of housing. So the government brought in a 15% tax on that kind of buying, clearly targeting people from mainland China. So they did that. And what the premier announced last week as an incentive for foreign buyers who are coming to live here and work here was she announced that henceforth, people who come to Canada, to British Columbia on work permits, would be exempt from paying this 15% tax. So if you're coming here on a work permit, you've got a job, you're coming in because you have expertise. So that can be expertise in any field, but a lot of the tech companies use those people in particular, our film industry, some kinds of construction where there are very specialized skills. But it is skewed toward entrepreneurial companies in the tech sector, and those people will no longer have to pay the tax. In fact, the government, Bill, has even said that people who come here on work permits since last summer and who paid the tax and who qualify might be in line for a rebate. So it's a pretty big lure. The tax on a big piece of property, a home, a residential home in Vancouver, will run you to tens of thousands of dollars. So the premier is offering a fair size waiver in order to try to take advantage of what we see as an opportunity in the tech sector.
Okay, tech companies and their foreign workers, consider that tax break on your British Columbia home. Meanwhile, Vaughn, I want to talk about this foreign buyer tax because we talked about it. It was a big deal, controversial when it was passed last summer. What has the impact been?
Well, the intended effect, Bill, was to end widespread speculation in real estate in and around the city of Vancouver, particularly in residential properties, by foreign buyers who were just buying for speculative purposes, not coming here to live and work. And it's worked. Those people have, that section of the market has pretty much collapsed. Prices have dropped at the high end. There aren't nearly as many buyers coming in. They don't want to pay the tax. It's a lot of money. And they've gotten the message that they're not welcome here. I see from page 3 of the Wall Street Journal today, Bill, that they've gone to Seattle.
Yeah.
That there's been a surge down there. And exactly the same kind of buyers we're seeing in British Columbia this time last year. Very well heeled. You're getting bidding wars for property, and people are noticing that a lot of these buyers are from mainland China. They want to get their money out of the country. They see our part of the world as a great investment. They see it as stable. And they are no longer seeing Vancouver as a welcoming place because of that premium tax. They're on their way to your city.
Right. So homeowners and shoppers, you can give blame or credit, some of it to British Columbia. Finally, Vaughn, the tax money that came into BC, what have you been doing with all the money?
Well, yeah, the British Columbia government did get a windfall from this because the run-up in these property sales ran for a couple of years before they stepped in to deal with it. So they got a lot of revenue in, hundreds of millions of dollars. The big thing they've done with it that I think is positive is they took about $500 million of that money, so a very large fund, and they announced that it was available to build social housing. So this is mostly rental housing for people who are needy in one sense or another. They're low income, victims of violence, Aboriginal people, seniors, other groups, the disabled. And what the government basically said was, so we've got this cash. It's available to March 31st of this year, so the end of next month. And if you come to us, local council or nonprofit society, with a proposal that's ready to go, we'll back it. And so far, a lot of that money that was available has been taken up. So there was a positive result of this real estate speculation here. There were some negative results, too, but one of the positive things was they at least they made good use of the money they were getting.
There's an update on this housing crush that we talk about here in the Seattle area. They certainly talk about in expensive, expensive British Columbia. And the news coming to you from Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, who joins us regularly. Vaughn, thanks a lot.
Talk to you next week, Bill. Bye-bye.
And finally today, his spokesman says President Trump was standing up for his daughter when he posted a tweet today criticizing Nordstrom. Trump tweeted that Ivanka Trump was treated so unfairly by the Seattle department store, which decided to stop selling her clothing and accessory line. Shares in Nordstrom fell in a flurry of trading after that tweet, but by early afternoon, they'd recovered and were actually trading higher. The White House spokesperson, Sean Spicer, says Trump was responding to an attack on his daughter. It's KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today.